All right, good afternoon, everybody. It is Thursday afternoon, May 6th, 12:40. We're here for lecture, and we're going to do a switch. We've been doing Diels Alder reactions. We did a couple of days on Diels Alder reactions, and I wanted to go into the paracyclic stuff, but I'm conscientious that there is more important chemistry that we need to cover, and my time is limited. So I want to go and skip the rest of the paracyclic reactions. We'll just focus on the Diels Alder for that chapter. And we're going to jump into chapter 19 with aldehydes and ketones. And we're going to look at the aldehyde and ketone chemistry. And like I said, this chemistry is much more important as it starts to get into biological chemistry. It starts to get into things that are towards carbohydrates and starting to understand chemistry that that surrounds nucleic acids and proteins and amino acids and all of that stuff we start that by looking at the aldehydes and ketone stuff. So that's what I want to jump into. And let me go ahead and start a screen share. And we'll start off chapter 19. Oh, and by the way, for the afternoon group, we are going to do more Diels Alder reactions. This morning, we did a bunch of Diels Alder reactions. In fact, what we did is we actually worked on the co-op and worked the co-op problems that are more challenging, which gave us an opportunity to ask a lot of questions in the morning class regarding how some of those Diels Alder reactions work. So we'll do the same in the afternoon. We'll pick that up in the afternoon. So we're not quite done with Diels Alder, but we're done in terms of lecture and spending lecture time on it. Get up the chat so I can see that. Okay, good to go. So this is going to be chapter 19. And it's aldehydes and ketones. Okay, I just have to share this for a second because I'm writing with this pen now. Hang on a second. Let me stop the share. So I spent some time writing out all these notes. And if you look really closely at these notes, my handwriting actually looks pretty decent. I've got some nice little structures in here and things. That's because, well, partially because I was writing with this. I don't know if you can see what that is. That's a Mont Blanc Meisterstruck pen. It's my father's pen. It's gold and platinum and like the most expensive pen I have ever used. And I write all my lecture notes with it. And it has this nice tactile feel. And then you go to an iPad and you write on this with this. And it's just not the same. It's just not.
Jason, have you heard of the covers for the iPads that make it feel like paper? Because I have one and I really like it. It's like, makes it a little bit more smooth.
Okay, so you're the first person that I've ever talked to who's actually used that. I've seen that ad a bunch of times and I thought, yeah. I'm not buying it, I don't know. But it actually works, it feels better.
It's like a matte screen protector and it just lays on flat. And then I really like it because I feel like the shiny surface gets kind of like sticky, if that makes sense.
It does, indeed, which is why you see me cleaning mine all the time.
Yeah.
Okay, so it gives it a little bit more resistance, a little more tactile feel? Yeah. Awesome, okay.
I don't think they're super expensive either, but.
I don't think so.
You can probably get them on like Amazon. They come in like a 3-pack, I think.
All right, yeah. I'm gonna try that. Thank you for that, that's awesome. Because I've been wondering about those. I keep looking at those and I keep thinking, I'm going to spend money on these things and then I'm going to hate them. But yeah, there is something about slowing it down a little bit and having a little bit more resistance that the Apple Pen just kind of glides on that surface and it's hard to get your writing the way that you want it. Okay, so as we start aldehydes and ketones, a little bit of nomenclature. I don't spend much nomenclature time in aldehydes and ketones, very little, but just so that we have a basic, butane. When you throw an aldehyde onto it, still the four carbons, you've got the but, but now it's butanal, and we end in the AL ending for the aldehyde functional group. So we just change the ending to AL for aldehyde. If you have a longer carbon chain, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and something in here, so that this is 1, 2, 3, 4, 4 methyl octanol or octane. There we go. And then we change and we put the aldehyde functional group, but let's put it up here on the branch. The interesting thing about this is that the longest carbon chain must contain the aldehyde. So the molecule takes on where this was the longest carbon chain before, where we got the octane. Now we have to take on the aldehyde as being the parent chain. And so we get a new number of carbons, and this is going to be 4, 1, 2, 3, 4 propyl, pentanal. So that's how we do that with the aldehydes. Some common aldehydes and common aldehyde names. Something that crops up all the time, formaldehyde. Every time we have a one hydrogen and a carbon, that's a formal group. And so the formal group is a CH group. And that's where that name comes from. And so that's formaldehyde. Two carbon chain, a C aldehyde. Or ethanal would be the way that we would do that. The aromatic takes on benzaldehyde. So some common names and a little systematic name thrown in there too for the ethanol. Ketones, ketones are similar. So as we start to look at ketones, we can take that same concept of butane and throw a ketone into it, and it becomes butanone. So the O-N-E ending is the ketone ending. If it's a longer carbon chain that we're dealing with, so 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, this would be hexane, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Then I need to distinguish between the different isomers that I can create so that this one would be 1, 2, 3, 3 hexanone versus 2 hexanone. And then there are other ways that we can name these as well. This can be ethyl, propyl, ketone, or methyl, 1, 2, 3, 4 butyl ketone. Sometimes you'll see that they'll name them similar to an ether, where they name one side and the other side, and then they throw a ketone name in there. So that's another way in which they are sometimes named. And then there are also some common ones. Acetone. This one is acetophenone. So that one, the name is coming from a seat group. In the way that that's being named. And if you have two aromatic rings, then this takes on benzophenone. So just some common ways that we name aldehydes and ketones. I won't test you on the aldehyde ketone nomenclature, but it's good to have some base foundation for looking at that. Let's do some formation of aldehydes and ketones. We already know a whole bunch of ways to make aldehydes and ketones. So this is basically just quick review of some of the things that we've already done. We took alcohols that were primary alcohols. And found that if we oxidized them, so the symbol for oxidation, and we could use several different oxidizing agents, PDC or PCC, or SWERN, all of these different oxidizing agents that were mild oxidizing agents allowed us to be able to take and convert these into aldehydes. So these were all mild oxidizing reagents. Another way that we had was to take alkenes and to treat them with ozonolysis. And if we wanted the aldehyde, then we had to be careful of what workup we did. We had to do a reductive workup. Out of the reductive workups, there were two primarily. Zinc and water was one, or dimethyl sulfoxide, DMS, or dimethyl sulfide, not dimethyl sulfoxide. DMS is dimethyl sulfide. So this is that's that guy. Okay, so what this did is it broke the bond and left us with two aldehydes. And depending on the R groups could be the same or different, but it was a way that we could access aldehydes was going through ozonolysis. A third way was to use alkynes. You remember how to get an aldehyde from an alkyne? Sometimes you have to look back and find those things or try to remember what they were. We wanted to try to form the enolate or the enol out here on this carbon, which means that we want to have the addition be out on the primary carbon. And the only way to get that...
9-BBN?
Yes. I'm going to do it in general. 9-BBN is an example. That's good. But it could be any of the dialkyl boranes that would allow us to be able to do that. And secondary step would be the oxidation step, which is sodium hydroxide, hydrogen peroxide, and water. And that allows us to convert that into the aldehyde. So that's another way that we could go through and we can do that. How about if we wanted to make some ketones out of these. So if we want to make ketones and we're looking at the same sort of principles, we could start with a secondary alcohol. And the secondary alcohol we could oxidize, but here we could use any oxidizing agent. So Jones would have been okay. We could have used PCC, pyridinium chlorochromate. We could have used pyridinium dichromate. We could have used SWERN. Any of these oxidizing agents would work on the secondary and would take us squarely up to the ketone. Following in that same pattern, if we had an appropriately substituted alkene, we could do ozonolysis. And here the workup is not so critical. We could do reductive or oxidative. And that splits that bond, gives us the two R groups, and allows us to be able to create ketones. A little hard to control because you've got to isolate away from something else if it's not symmetrical, or something gets thrown away if it's not symmetrical. So that's a little bit harder, but the possibility is there. We can go back to that alkyne concept. And here, what we want to do is we want to get the hydroxyl group to go in the Markovnikov edition, standard edition. So this one's a little bit easier, because this one is just water with H2SO4 and mercury sulfate. Actually, I was going to do that, but the R group's directly connected in that case. If we're looking at the carbons number one and number two, number one and number two. So we make sure we don't accidentally add in the carbon in there. And then out of the aromatic chapter, we also found that we could take and we could do Friedel-Crafts acylations. And there was a couple of different ways that we could do this. So one way was to use things like an anhydride, or we could use an acid chloride, and then AlCl3 together with either of these. And if we had R groups that were on these, then we could add that in and add in the R group. So there was another way that we could go through and make ketones. And perhaps the last way is using an aldehyde to make a ketone. So how do I make a ketone out of an aldehyde? Well, tell me what this sequence would do. So I'll use a Grignard, and then I'll use dilute acid. What's that going to give me with that aldehyde as that Grignard reacts with that aldehyde? So the Grignard attacks, carbonyl opens up, goes tetrahedral, gets protonated by the acid. So what I make here is I first make the secondary alcohol. And then we can oxidize that secondary alcohol with something like Jones, creating the ketone. And so we can create ketones of our choice, starting from aldehydes, by doing an alkyl addition first and then followed by an oxidation.
Could you
go for it?
Could you remind me if Jones, when applied to an aldehyde, did that take it to a carboxylic acid, or am I thinking of something else?
No, you are absolutely correct. Okay. And so let's do that as a little note here, which is why we weren't using Jones on the aldehydes, is because if I took an aldehyde and I react it with Jones, which is the CR2CRO3 plus H2SO4, that takes and oxidizes this all the way up to the carboxylic acid. And that's the same problem with a primary alcohol. So I could say that I could take a primary alcohol and or an aldehyde and use Jones, and it will oxidize it all the way up to the carboxylic acid. So that's a little bit problematic, because if I'm trying to get to an aldehyde or ketone, once I've oxidized this up to a carboxylic acid, now it's hard to get it back into a ketone. Because what happens with this is that if you take the carboxylic acid and you think, oh, I'm just going to go ahead and do the Grignard reaction, and two, then I'll acidify it. But the problem with that is that the Grignard, being sort of like a carbanion, grabs the proton, kicking the electrons back. And so your first step that you create is you wind up creating the carboxylate and RH, the hydrocarbon. And then upon protonation, as you add the acid back to it, you just create your carboxylic acid back again. But now you've destroyed your Grignard. And so, so once you have oxidized it all the way up to a carboxylic acid, now things are complicated. Now it's a little bit harder to deal with. So we've got to try and do other things. So that's why I was trying to, that's why I avoided the Jones with the primary alcohol or the aldehyde. All right, so the primary function, as we start to look at aldehydes and ketones, the primary function of these is nucleophilic addition. So what we're doing here is we're taking a carbonyl, which is sp2 hybridized. It's flat and planar. So if we think about it as being flat and planar, and then a nucleophile that comes in negatively charged attacks the carbonyl carbon because of the polarity that is established here. One of these is supposed to be negative, not positive, because of the carbonyl. And so we get nucleophilic attack at the carbonyl carbon. Electrons shift up onto the oxygen, and we go to something which is now tetrahedral. And the nucleophile is attached, and we're now sp3. So that's the main type of reactivity that we're going to see for all of these. And sometimes you'll hear this talked about. I don't think it's in the chapter, but it's good to it's good to show you for a second. Let's just leave that as a CH3. If the nucleophile comes in on this face, and by face, what face am I talking about? Let's take this and draw it out flat so that we can clearly see faces. If the nucleophile comes from the top and this opens up, it creates this guy. And if the nucleophile comes from the bottom, it opens up and creates this guy. What's the relationship between these two?
Enantiomers.
They are. They're enantiomers. In other words, these things that are asymmetrical like this, aldehydes and ketones, are prochiral and can react to form stereocenter and produce a pair of enantiomers. And they oftentimes have different faces associated with them. For instance, if I went through and I assumed that the nucleophile was of lower priority than the oxygen, and I just assigned priority and I said, all right, oxygen's gonna be number one, hydrogen's gonna be number four, and maybe I make the nucleophile number two and this guy number three, and I do the same thing here, 2, 1, 4, and three. Then when I set this up and I ask, you know, what is the stereocenter that's being created? I have to view this from the back side. I would be going 1, 2, 3, swap it around. This is an R configuration. That makes this one an S configuration. And that makes this face up here the re face. And this face down here, the psi face. The re face leads to an R enantiomer when it reacts on the re face. The psi face leads to an S enantiomer when it reacts on the psi face. Just ways of referring to those different faces of the carbonyls. So it's just an interesting idea that they can be prochiral and that they lead to different things. Okay, there are many different types of nucleophiles that we can look at. So many different types of nucleophiles that can come in and react with these guys that we're going to look at in this chapter. So what we're going to explore are oxygen types. These are just going to be simply water, alcohols, and diols. Step down in the same family in the periodic table, and you're looking at sulfur. And we can look at dihydrogen sulfide. We could look at thiols, but we tend to bypass thiols for the dithiols. Thiols are not as interesting as dithiols. They do some, dithiols have some interesting properties in the way they react with things. Nitrogen, we'll look at some nitrogen nucleophiles, the analogous NH3. The alcohol equivalents, the amines, and we'll look at secondary amines as being different than primary amines. So we'll look at primary and secondary. Tertiary, not as interesting. Hydrogen, of course, we can have our reductions. So we have our reducing agents where we have BH4 and LH4, borohydride, aluminum hydride, and then some carbon nucleophiles, which we've already spent some time looking at. These are your Grignards. Things like cyano groups. And then a new one that we'll add into it that I've alluded to already previously. And this is the Wittig reagent. And so we'll introduce this new carbon nucleophile as being able to react with aldehydes and ketones and what it does. And this is the only one that you probably don't have a name for, TTIG. So that's our Wittig reagent. And these guys, I said the word, but these guys are called thiols. Oh, and alkyne, yeah. JC, that's another good one, is that alkyne, this one here, the cyano group is like the alkynyl anions in that it's a carbon nitrogen triple bond, but we certainly could. I don't think they do that in this chapter as much, but we certainly could include our alkynyl anions in there as possible reagents to react with things as well. Okay, so those are all the things that we want to look at and explore and try and hit as we go through this chapter. But as we're starting to look at those, there's also a different set of conditions under which aldehydes and ketones can react. Aldehydes and ketones can react under basic conditions. Basic conditions are fairly simple reaction conditions, where we have the aldehyde or ketone and the nucleophile comes in negatively charged, attacks, and this then opens up. You get the O minus. That then goes through a protonation step where it picks up a proton from the solvent or a subsequent acid addition. And so we end up that way. Or we could do it under acidic conditions. And under those acidic conditions, we start with a protonation first. The protonation activates, weakening the carbon-oxygen double bond such that we had a small partial positive to start with, but now I have a monster partial positive at the carbonyl. So this activates it for nucleophilic attack. The nucleophiles in these cases are generally neutral nucleophiles that have a proton attached to them rather than an anion. They tend to be neutral. We get the nucleophilic addition. The alcohol results remaining protonated or remaining, yeah, protonated. The nucleophile now, though, takes on a positive charge, and the nucleophile needs to be deprotonated as a final step. So some base pulls the proton, kicking electrons back to the nucleophile. And we end up with something that's got a lone pair on it in some way, generally. So these are the two main reaction pathways, either under basic conditions or under acidic conditions. And we'll see that there'll be some differences, some little nuances in these mechanisms as we go through, but primarily these are the two main reaction mechanisms. And so we'll just have to see and look at each set of conditions. Are we under basic conditions or are we under acidic conditions as we start to look at them? And the other concept is a concept of reactivity. Reactivity of aldehydes versus ketones. Which ones are more reactive? And what we'll find is that it's a combination of sterics and electronics that we'll need to consider. Let's talk about the steric effect first. If I have an aldehyde versus a ketone, which one has more sterics?
The ketone.
Ketone has more sterics. Yeah. And so the way to think about these is really to think about the fact that the R group is tetrahedral and that there's free rotation about the sigma bond. And so this group over here is small for the hydrogen. And this is where your sterics are really coming into play. And when you look at the ketone has two of those sp3 hybridized groups on it and free rotation about those sigma bonds. So the ketone has more sterics. Okay, that's an important factor. Now the electronic factor, and I'm going to differ than the book at this point. Because I have a question for you. In the NMR chapter, when we're looking at the CNMR, and I don't have the CNMR table on me. Let me get one real quick. Man, I don't have a good one. Here's the problem. Ketones and aldehydes. The ketone is downfield of the aldehyde. So if I,
It froze.
Thank you.
Nope, it's back.
Sweet. I put something in front of it. And when I put something in front of it, it does that. Okay. So ketones, if I have a molecule that has both a ketone and an aldehyde in it, what I'll see is that the ketone peak in the carbon NMR is downfield of the aldehyde peak. Why would that be? Why would the ketone peak be downfield of the aldehyde peak? Or what is it telling you that the ketone peak is downfield of the aldehyde peak?
That it's more deshielded.
That's right. Now, what does deshielding correlate to in terms of partial positive? Which one has the larger partial positive?
The one that's more deshielded, right?
That's right. So that has the large partial positive and this has the small. That means that aldehydes have the small partial positive and ketones the large. Okay, now the question. This is a fact. This is just the way it is when you look at NMR. There's no debating this fact. And if we go in WebMO and we calculate the partial positive on a ketone versus an aldehyde in the same molecule, we'll see that the ketone has the much larger partial positive. This goes counter to what the book is telling you. Because the book is telling you, hey, don't look too closely because we want your world to be okay. The book is telling you that I have two electron donating groups on a ketone. And therefore, because I have two electron donating groups on a ketone, that I should have the smaller partial positive. And I only have one electron donating group on an aldehyde, and therefore the aldehyde should have the larger partial positive. But this is wrong.
Isn't it just, it's able to support a larger partial positive because of that?
Well, that's a good question. And the answer is yes to that. But the question is, does it have a larger partial positive? Because if we say, if we go with this model and we say that methyl groups are donating and the oxygen is pulling away. And so because the electron donating groups here are stabilizing this positive charge, they're donating to it and they're reducing it. And this one has one electron donating group. And therefore, it cannot stabilize this as much in the partial positive results that is greater here. So if you look in the book gives this argument and tells you that an aldehyde is more reactive because it has a larger partial positive. But in fact, it does not. It's actually the other way around. It's actually... actually, that this guy has the larger partial positive and the aldehyde has a smaller partial positive. And that's the way it really is. Now, Bibi, you're saying that because these are electron donating groups, that they allow greater buildup of partial positive charge. And in some cases in WebMO and certain exercises, we have seen that a tertiary carbocation has a greater buildup of partial positive charge because it can support it more, it can hold it more. That's a little bit different than what's actually going on here. What's actually going on here is that we're seeing that these alkyl groups are not really, truly electron donating. Interestingly enough, they're actually electron withdrawing groups. And I haven't been lying to you all this time, but I also haven't entirely been telling you the truth. It turns out that when we have a carbocation and you want to look at a carbocation stability and the hyperconjugation model, that in the hyperconjugation model, hyperconjugation works because of the sigma bond donating to the p empty p orbital that is the carbocation, and this is our sigma bond. And so this is our hyperconjugation model. This is what we are using to explain and account for induction, or at least inductively donating.
So it could do the same thing and displace a positive charge too.
No, what's actually happening is that
I'm crying.
Yeah, I know. What's actually happening is it's only donating when there's an empty p orbital to donate to. And that when the empty p orbital is here and this group can donate to that empty p orbital, it will do so and it will act as an electron donating group. Stop. Okay. But what happens if there is no carbocation? If there is no carbocation, and if there is no carbocation, and I have a carbon out here, then is this electron donating? There's nothing to donate to, and there's no reason to donate. And you can say, well, there's the pi bond there, and maybe it's donating in through hyperconjugation to the pi bond. But in reality, it doesn't donate unless there's some reason for it to donate, or specifically an empty p orbital for it to donate into. And in absence of that empty p orbital, it functions more as an electron adjoining group.
Is that just because, like, when you put the positive charge on the carbon, it makes it electrophilic enough to, like, have there be a big enough, like, electronegativity difference to take the electrons?
You know, that might be very much part of it. It also may be that hyperconjugation is just not that great a model, because hyperconjugation is assuming, this is just an interesting idea here, hyperconjugation is assuming that this p orbital is separate from the sigma orbital, in that they're localized, right? That this p orbital is localized over this carbon, and that the sigma bond here can donate to it because it has the electron density and there's orbital overlap and it can do that. That's sort of a fancy hand-waving model in hyperconjugation, because in reality, the orbitals all coexist at the same time and they're delocalized over the entire molecule, and that orbitals are not localized in particular positions and donate to each other. They are all part of the same molecule. So the hyperconjugation component, while nice and pretty and allows for something to hold on to for you to understand, kind of falls apart at the molecular orbital level. And this idea then of hyperconjugation just doesn't quite do it. So what we say is, what we learn out of this is that when there is a carbocation, methyl groups can be electron donating, and that we'll see that they have this sort of electron donating capacity. But in the absence of a carbocation, then alkyl groups are electron withdrawing groups more so. And that the ketone is actually more deshielded than an aldehyde. But this leads to an interesting idea now, because which one of these would we assume is more reactive? Is the aldehyde more reactive, or is the ketone more reactive for nucleophilic addition? Sterics play a much bigger role than electronics in terms of the way that these things react. So now let's look at some other data. I love this part because it's just not as nice and pretty as we assume it is. And the deeper down the rabbit hole you get, the more interesting things get. Organic chemistry will continue to surprise you. And you will never run out of new things to study. It is one of the most fascinating subjects just because of that just the deeper you go, the more interesting and more fascinating it always gets. Okay, let's, in order to understand reactivity, we need to look at another reaction. So we're going to go where Keegan is saying, we're going to go to sterics and we're going to go to aldehydes and look at why aldehydes are more reactive. But in order to understand all of that, I'm going to couch it in a reaction, hydration. So hydration is where we take a carbonyl, it's a reversible reaction, we add water to it, and we make a hydrate. Hydrates are funny things. The equilibrium is generally supporting the carbonyl and only a little bit towards the hydrate. So the hydrate is not generally the main product, although for some molecules it is, if they are reacted with water. The mechanism of the reaction usually is an acidic mechanism. So let's go and do this acidic rather than basic. We start off by protonating the ketone. Once the ketone is protonated, water comes in and does a nucleophilic attack. That opens up the ketone. We go to tetrahedral. The incoming nucleophile is now protonated, and we will use some solvent or another water molecule to deprotonate to regenerate the acid. And we are now at the hydrate. So the mechanism's not complicated. Now what we want to do is we want to use this reaction to understand rate. So what we're going to do is we're going to take that reaction and we'll draw it here with two different R groups, R and R prime. We'll add water to it. We'll create the hydrate. R prime, R, and the two OHs. And what we're going to look is we're going to look at a rate that is a relative rate by looking at the rate of the reaction divided by the rate of acetaldehyde. So acetaldehyde is going to be our benchmark for rate. So when we look at acetaldehyde in this reaction, and this is relative rate, acetaldehyde is going to be 1 because that's our benchmark. So we take something smaller than acetaldehyde, maybe formaldehyde, and we take something bigger. Tertiobutylaldehyde. And we look at these relative rates. What we find is that this one is 2200 and this one is 0.09. So what is going on? This one just has very small sterics. And that sterics are increasing. Which are slowing down the rate for nucleophilic attack. The interesting thing, though, comes in when I decide to look at acetone. Because how do you think that acetone is going to compare with the tertiobutyl group? Is it going to be more reactive, less reactive? Seems like it would be less sterics, doesn't it? Trick question. About the same. Watch this, 0.0018. It's way less reactive. Because now there's sterics on both sides. And while there was a clear path towards the aldehyde, because you could come around that proton, and that proton is really, really tiny. The second you put two tetrahedral groups on here, even though they're just two methyl tetrahedral groups, the rate drops tremendously, which is fascinating. But we can overwhelm that rate. So if I take all of this and move these over for a second, and I'll put one in here. This molecule has as much sterics as the acetone. But this one reacts at approximately 22,000 because the partial positive is so much larger. And the partial positive being so large overwhelms the sterics. And so it's a balance of increasing partial positive. It's a balance of sterics and electronics. And that we can see both that are at play. And so as we go towards the right-hand side here, yes, the partial positive is increasing. Maybe not quite that much. But then as we really increase that partial positive, electronics start to play over here while sterics are dominating on the other side. So it's a combination of sterics and electronics. But what we get out of this is that in general, aldehydes are much more reactive than ketones. And it's due to lower sterics. So that's the big takeaway out of that. Okay, how are we doing? You guys keeping up? Any questions? Checking in, seeing how things are sitting. Sometimes I drop these bombs and then it takes a while for you guys to recover. Or contemplate or say, I know nothing. I thought I knew everything, but I know nothing. All right, seems like you guys are doing okay. You take these things in stride, you start figuring it out. But it's okay not to know everything. The first reaction that I want to cover with these that sort of like starts us off down the path is called acetal formation. I'm going to start a new page. Start here. And I'm going to throw in another word, ketal. I think the book uses acetals almost exclusively, but it's important to know the difference between an acetal and a ketal. They're very, very similar. If you start off with an aldehyde, and you take and you add two equivalents of alcohol, and you do this under acidic conditions, there's a first step in the addition where what we create is something that has an OH and an OR group. So if we track the OR group, and we track this guy. This is called a hemiacetal, and the acetal is taken from the aldehyde name. And I said it was two equivalents of alcohol because the reaction continues. And when you add the second equivalent of alcohol, it replaces the OH altogether. The proton is still here that allows us to recognize that this came from an aldehyde, but now there are two of the alcohol groups that have been added, and this is now a full acetal. The difference between these reactions is that the hemiacetal is reversible, but the acetal is not easily reversible. And the ketal name, where a ketal comes from, is from a ketone. That when you start off with a ketone, we can do the exact same set of reactions, two equivalents of alcohol, H plus. First step is the hemiketal. Second step, not as easily reversible. To the full ketal. And so we're taking that name from a ketone, ketal, hemiketal, and ketal. So the only difference between them, if you look at what's going on here, and we work from the acetal and the ketal. Two oxygens, both of them ethers, connected to the same carbon with a proton on that same carbon. The proton indicates that this came from an aldehyde, and therefore it's an acetal. If we have a carbon that has two oxygens on it, both of those oxygens are R groups, are ether type oxygens, then, and there's no proton connected to that carbon, then it came from a ketone, and that is a ketal. So the key thing is look for the presence or absence of the hydrogen on the carbon that the two oxygens are connected to. And that's how you tell them apart. This acid that we're using is different than most other acids that we have used before. If you watch, and we'll go through the reaction mechanism. I'll show you the reaction mechanism. But what's happening here is we're removing the oxygen and we're losing two hydrogens. And as we lose the oxygen and two hydrogens, we're losing an equivalent of water. So water is coming off of this thing. You have to lose water, which means that you don't want any water in this reaction. In fact, what you want to do is you want to get rid of water in this chemical reaction. Most of the acids that we've dealt with are soluble only in water. So we need an acid that is not water soluble. We need an acid, well, it could be water soluble, but we need an acid that is soluble in organic reagents. That's what we need. So there's a particularly special acid that we use. The most common is paratoluyl sulfonic acid. And when you look at this, I think you'll recognize what this is. It's paratoluyl sulfonic acid. And so they pull the PTSA and they call it PTSA. The other name that they use that is probably going to look a little more familiar to you is TS, capital T, lowercase s, TSOH. I think, well, wait a minute, TSOH. Okay, I haven't ever seen TSOH, but you have seen TSO, right? You've seen this. You've seen, oops, where I have OTS. What is that OTS? It's a tosylate group, right? And that's what this is that this is the tosylate group. And they are one and the same, so that the nomenclature actually matches and fits that when we look at this guy, Cl, this was TSCl, tosyl chloride. And so all they're doing is they're pulling this part of the name as the tosylate group. And then they're tagging on the OH for the alcohol, but it's not really an alcohol, it's really an acid, just as we would tag on the Cl for the tosyl chloride. But it's exactly the same thing. So I almost exclusively use PTSA because when I was in undergraduate and when I did my graduate studies, that was the way that this acid was named and the way that I've always referred to it and used it. The book likes to use tosyl TSOH a lot, but they are one and the same. And so I just want you to be able to recognize them, that if I'm flip-flopping and I forget to use TSOH and I use PTSA, or you see it someplace, just because that's what I'm more frequently used, that they are one and the same. Okay, let me show you this mechanism of how these reactions work. We start off and we will work with the ketone because it's symmetrical and a little bit easier to track. It's an acid catalyzed reaction. So your first step is to use acid. Go ahead and protonate the carbonyl. Once the carbonyl is protonated, the next step is nucleophilic attack. The protonation activates the partial positive at the carbonyl. You can think of it almost like resonance. If I pull the electrons up, I get a full-fledged carbocation here. That's my electrophilic center, right there. Electrons attack that center, break this bond, lift the electrons up onto the oxygen. Now the alcohol that came in, the oxygen with three bonds to it, bears the positive charge. So the next step is to use the conjugate base of whatever acid we brought in and deprotonate this thing with that conjugate base. This takes us to the first step, and the hemiacetal or ketal. In this case, we're dealing with ketones, so it's a hemiketal. To push the reaction forward, we need to create a good leaving group and to get rid of the OH altogether. That happens by protonating the oxygen and creating that good leaving group. Okay, the next step is the most important, because now what people want to do is people want to take another alcohol and slam it into this and do an SN2 reaction. But there is no SN2 reactions. These don't go by SN2 reactions. These go by what's called assisted leaving. The electrons push in and push out. Okay, now notice the similarities. Notice that we protonated the carbonyl, which activated the carbonyl, which allowed for nucleophilic attack. We now have something that looks like a protonated carbonyl, except for the fact that this isn't a proton, it's an alkyl group, and it can't come off. There is no other way to alleviate this positive charge than for some nucleophile to come in and attack this. And that's the next step. So another equivalent now of alcohol comes in and performs a nucleophilic attack. Shift the electrons up onto the oxygen. We have the positive charge now on the nucleophile that came in. And the last step is to take the proton away to give the electrons back to the oxygen. And now we're at the full ketone. And what we have created is an equivalent of water. And that water somehow needs to be removed. There are a couple of different ways of removing the water. The most common way to remove the water is to use a special reaction apparatus designed to actually remove water, which is really kind of a cool apparatus. So what is oftentimes done to remove the water is to use an apparatus that looks like this. We have the round bottom. The round bottom is attached to a piece that curves. And comes into another piece of glassware. This piece of glassware goes up and connects onto a condenser. And so now there's a ground glass joint that sits here. And a water jacketed condenser that fits on this. And water goes in and out. So this is the condenser. And this piece gets heated. And what winds up happening is we use a solvent. Usually toluene or benzene that azeotropes with water. That means that as this reaction is heated and refluxing, the solvent travels up over this, comes over to here, goes up, and then it condenses back down and drops down as a liquid, so that liquid starts to acquire over here. The liquid, as it acquires, is rich in water, because what an azeotrope is a constant boiling fraction of the solvent and the water. So the solvent and water, the water, as long as it's being evolved, is being carried over here, hits the condenser, drops down as a liquid, and then as it sits over here, the concentration of water increases to the point where it starts to separate from the benzene or the toluene. And because water is more dense, the water starts to build up in the bottom of this container. And then it separates from the hydrocarbon. And then that hydrocarbon drops back down and actually physically removes water. So this is our liquid benzene or toluene. And this is the water, which is actually sequestered from the chemical reaction. And what they have is gradation marks on this. So you can actually measure the volume of water that comes out. And you can tell when your reaction is done by calculating the volume of water that would be liberated when you go through and do the reaction. And this whole thing is called a Dean Stark trap. And so you'll oftentimes see these reactions written that they will take and write it this way with methanol, PTSA, Dean Stark. And you know then that you are doing acetal formation or ketal formation. And the Dean Stark is about removing water. So there are two ways to remove water. The other way is, of course, to remove water chemically, to use something that will actually destroy the water. But so many of our other reagents are water reactive, or reactive to those dangerous chemicals, that the Dean Stark trap is just a convenient way to be able to remove water physically and not have to impact your chemistry at all, which is really kind of cool. All right, let me, in just 2 minutes here, which you don't need to write down, I'll bring this back again. I just want to show you something really quickly. Why are we spending so much time on these guys, acetals and ketals? Well, it's because when you get to these guys, this is D-glucopyranose, otherwise known as D-glucose. And if I take D-glucose and combine it with an equivalent of fructose, then I can make an equivalent of sucrose, which is table sugar. Takes me a minute to draw, but okay, so this one is sucrose or table sugar. It's a disaccharide. This one's a monosaccharide. So disaccharide, monosaccharide. Saccharide is a sugar. Monosaccharide, single sugar. Disaccharide, disugar. Look at the oxygen connected to an R group, connected to a carbon, connected to an OH. There is also connected to this a hydrogen, which sits in that location. Anybody tell me what functional group that is?
The hemiacetal.
It's a hemiacetal, yeah. Almost all monosaccharides are hemiacetals or hemiketals. And they open and close because of the reversibility of that hemiacetal or hemiketal. And they go by the exact same mechanism that we just reviewed. So they work and function exactly that way. Look at this one. This one has two oxygens connected to the same carbon. There is a hydrogen that sits here. Both of these oxygens are ether type oxygens. And because they're ether type oxygens, they're both R groups that are connected to that. And so this one is a full acetal. And the formation of that disaccharide, or the breaking, the hydrolysis of that disaccharide, goes by the exact reverse mechanism that we showed for its formation. And so all of sugar chemistry can be understood by understanding acetals and hemiacetals and ketals and hemiketals. That's where all of the chemistry comes from for those. There's nothing different. There's just a lot more carbons and oxygens to keep track of. And that's all it is. The other big thing that we'll learn when we come back on Tuesday is that that this guy, which is a ketal, can be used as a protecting group. Because I can take, and I can treat this with water and acid. H2SO4. And I can take it back off. And so it's easy to put on, and it's easy to take off. And because of that, I can turn it into a protecting group to be able to hide and protect my ketone. And I can do all kinds of other chemistry once that ketone is hiding. I can do other things to double bonds or triple bonds, or I can create other aldehydes or ketones and do things to them. And then I can remove this and get my ketone back. So all kinds of chemistry is going to become available to us through these protecting groups and also the understanding of carbohydrate chemistry. All has its foundation and basis in that mechanism right there. So an extremely important mechanism in everything that we're doing. Okay. All right, that's my time, 2 o'clock. I'm of course available for questions. So I'll keep the tape rolling here for a few more minutes, and I'll stay on the line and pummel me away with questions if you've got them.
Thank you.
You're welcome. See you, Abby. You're welcome, Loki.
What do you got, Sterling?
So I was wondering about the reversibility of the first, you know, step in the mechanism after you had the first equivalence of alcohol and the second one. Is it just because of like the bond enthalpies, you know, like on the left, you have a carbon double bonded to an oxygen, and on the right, you know, like the oxygen gets two bonds to carbon, so it's like happier.
I think it's more so the fact that you have an easy leaving group. When we say that the first step is reversible, and we add in one equivalent of alcohol, and we go to the hemiacetal, or hemiketal in this case, that the reason that this is so reversible is that the water, I guess the way to say this is that the hydroxyl group here is still connected, in that once water has left this mechanism and the water is gone, it becomes irreversible because there's no water to break it open and replace it. But as long as this hydroxyl group is still here, then this reaction mechanism can be reversed to take it back to its starting material. That I think that when we look at the reaction mechanism, if we do it this way, I think it makes more sense. Protonate it, take the proton. That's a reversible step. Attack with the alcohol. That's a reversible step. Deprotonate. That's a reversible step. So everything so far has been easily reversible. Now move forward and protonate the alcohol. That's a reversible step. So far, we're still good. Now we've got the leaving step. And I would say even this step is reversible. However, now we have a problem, because now once this is formed, the water is removed. And because the water is removed, once the water is removed, then this next step where the alcohol comes in and attacks and does the second attack, now because there's no water, this step is no longer reversible or not easily reversible. Because there's no water to be able to go back this direction. In fact, I guess what I should say is really, this is my irreversible point. Once that water leaves, I can't go back easily.
Okay.
This step, we can consider this step to be reversible, and we can go back to there. Yeah, but if there's no, water in it, then I can't get back through this step.
Right. That's what was kind of confusing me, was because like, yeah, is the very last step that you've drawn right now.
Right.
That one. The reverse, because you know that one seems like it is reversible, but so it's the water. When you lose water, you don't have that equilibrium anymore.
That's right. That's what's happening, is that it's that loss of water that makes this irreversible. And cool. So
add water, right?
Yeah, but that's why we say that these can be used as protecting groups, because if I take and I add water to this, then I can break this thing and take it back, but I have to add the water back.
Okay.
Because I removed that water using the Dean Stark. And that's why, you know, I think the other thing is, here's the other thing about this. If you look at this, I have a protic hydrogen. The protic hydrogen means that this thing can auto-catalyze to be able to go back this direction, because it has a source of acid and it can function as an acid and a base. It's amphoteric. And so being amphoteric, this naturally is reversible on its own. It doesn't need acid or base to be able to be reversed.
Right.
And so there's
it can react with itself is kind of what you're saying, right? Like,
that's right.
That proton is going to donate to another hemiacetal to make the leaving group. And then you're going to have the self-assisted leaving and stuff.
Correct.
Okay.
Cool. And so that'll have its own. So this can auto-catalyze, but look at this. There's no protons.
Right. Okay.
With no protons, it can't auto-catalyze.
That works for me. That's a good, that was a very solid explanation.
So this would work for any sugar?
It is a property of all sugars. Like if we take glucose and we look at glucose, glucose looks like this. I'm going to do its Fischer projection. So glucose has hydroxyl, and CH2OH. This is glucose. And this is what we would refer to as D-glucose. D-glucose is in equilibrium with its alpha and beta forms of the pyranose. And yes, this is true for all monosaccharides. It's in equilibrium here. With its alpha form. I always get confused between the alpha form and beta form. So if I screw that up, I apologize.
I don't know the difference.
It's not your job.
It's not your job. It's whether it's in an equatorial or axial position for this hydroxyl group. So these guys are what are referred to as anomers. They're isomers of a type, but they're isomers where it is different at one carbon and the location of the hydroxyl at the anomeric carbon. So this carbon is called the anomeric carbon. And it is the carbon of the acetal or ketal. And then it is also in equilibrium, this is the cool part, with two others. And so in solution, these guys are all in equilibrium together. And this one
biologicals are nuts.
All the what? Biologicals?
Yeah.
Okay, so these are the pyranoses and these are the furanoses. And glucose in water is a mixture of five different things. Glucose is not one thing. Glucose has a percentage that is like 38% this guy, 20-something. No, let's see, it's more than that. It's like 56 something, 40 something, and then a couple of percentages of the furanoses, and then like 0.03% open chain in some crazy mixture like that. And they're all in dynamic equilibrium, and you can see them all spectroscopically. And no matter what you do, they always are in that equilibrium, because they auto-catalyze and self-open. And that's just how they exist. That's just what glucose is.
Is that how cellulose breaks down into glucose?
It is, indeed.
And destroys itself?
Indeed. Cellulose, when you have cellulose is a mixture of the different, I hope I don't tank this too. long way.
All I know about cellulose is that it's the beta.
Yeah, which is, I think, what I'm doing. But I'm trying to get... I know what I'm doing wrong. It's the 1-4. And so what happens is this one is part of the polymer and keeps going. And this one keeps going. And so what we say is that it is the 1, 2, 3, 4. This is the beta 1-4. What do they call it?
Acidic linkage.
Yes. Thank you. That's awesome. And that beta 1-4 glycosidic linkage, what happens is that your body and the acid in your body hydrolyzes this extremely, extremely slowly and cannot efficiently break this down into glucose. It requires an enzyme to break this down into glucose. And only organisms which have that enzyme are actually able to convert this polymer from cellulose into glucose and then use it and break it down. Now we could take glucose and we could break down glucose and use it as a fuel. And in fact, it's the only fuel that your brain can use. But unless you have the right enzyme to break down that 1-4 beta glycosidic linkage, you can't do it. There is no animal that has that enzyme. The only animals that have that enzyme are insects and bacteria. Well, it's not even insects. I take it back. Insects don't. It's only bacteria. It's only bacteria that have this, not insects. It's the insects that have that bacteria in their gut that are that have a symbiotic relationship with that bacteria that are able to break this down. And for animals, what's that?
I was just going to say we can actually we have an extent of bacteria in our gut that can break these down about 30%.
Yeah, you can break down somewhat, but not enough to survive on it.
No, not fully, not really. That's the protein thing.
Right. Right. And so there are sorry. Organisms that eat only cellulose, and those organisms all have the symbiotic bacteria that actually break it down and convert it into glucose for them. And then their bodies take it the rest of the way.
But can't cellulose not, okay, because I don't know anything about biology, but can't cellulose, I forget, it's like acid catalyzed oxidation into glucose by itself in the presence of acid?
Yeah, yes. But I mean, that's pretty strong acid and very, very slow reaction. But I think what you're looking at in terms of, you're looking at, like,
I don't, okay, yeah, insects, whatever. Tell me.
No.
Paper.
You're concerned about the breakdown and the degradation of the paper and the autocatalysis that can happen with the paper. But your reaction is on a geologic timescale.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, your reaction that you're looking at, you're concerned with hundreds and thousands of years. Whereas the rest of us are concerned with the next 15 minutes and being able to get dinner. Paper. This is true.
Like newsprint can do that really fast. That's I true. Mean, on the same kind of scale.
Yes, yes. But newsprint does, yeah, newsprint does do that pretty fast. And that's because of the way in which newsprint is made, the type of paper that it's made out of, the process in which the newsprint is made, and probably the remains of acidic components within that paper that allow it to degrade that quickly.
Well, I've been reading a bunch of papers about it's both the buildup of weak acids on paper throughout time, but then there's some really interesting papers that are just about what, and this does bring it back to biochemistry. There's interesting papers that are done on the degradation of paper by metals that are present and acids that are present in the paper pulp itself all the way back to when it was a tree. And so it has to do with groundwater contamination in that life cycle being present in the paper itself.
Well, that's amazing. That's really cool. Because when you think about it, those metal ions that are part of the ecosystem and part of the organism living in the micronutrients that the organism needs, those metals are still there. Those metals are still there, and would function in that way. The other one I was going to say is CO2. I mean, if you take CO2 and you combine CO2 with water, you make carbonic acid. Why can't I do carbonic acid? CO3H, carbonic acid.
There it is.
Yeah, I just want to draw it. I just didn't want to write it. Polyhydroxy compounds are notorious for hydrogen bonding and holding water. And so as you're working with paper and as you're exhaling or large CO2 amounts just from respiration and other things can produce carbonic acid around that paper as well, which can then contribute to the acidic breakdown and things over time. So
just don't breathe on it and don't go to Hawaii.
Yeah.
Well, they figured it out in a kind of interesting way because that it had to be present in the pulp itself.
Uh-huh.
Because storing paper at cold temperatures in is it anaerobic if it's not around? No, that's just no bacteria, but no oxygen. No,
anaerobic is no oxygen.
Yeah. They found that it still degrades. And so they were like, okay, how is this happening? And then they realized that when they were testing what they did it on just blank paper. Mm-hmm. And several different kinds from like newsprint to acid free and the relative rates at which it was degrading. And I don't know how they do that, but they can do accelerated aging.
Mm-hmm.
They figured out that it doesn't help that much to actually, like it does help, but not as much as they thought to actually keep it sans oxygen.
So that's really hard then if the degradation is happening from within the paper, from constituents that were there when it was made, then the preservation of that material, it's not easily preserved, or there's nothing that you can, well, there might be things that you can do, but your choices are limited at that point because you're not trying to protect it from something from the outside. You have to remove something from the inside.
Yeah, they do like, what I was reading so far is that depending on what kind of paper, they do really weak acid baths, or really weak base baths, to try and counteract it. But they can't really like coat it or anything. I was talking to Zaruba, and Zaruba was like, they could polymerize, they could like plasticize it. And I was like, they can't plasticize it, but I don't know. It made me laugh because that is the way that not paper conservation works, but how they do that with products like what are they called, tablecloths and stuff.
Oh yeah, interesting. All right, I'm going to stop the recording.